listening to the Miles to Go podcast, the go-to source for travel tips, news, and reviews you can't afford to miss. Now, here's your host, travel expert Ed Pizza.
Welcome back to another episode of the Miles to Go podcast, where we bring you the latest travel news, tips, and tricks each week to help you save money while you travel better. Here's what we've got on tap for you in this week's episode. Late last week, United Airlines announced some changes to their elite status levels. If you're a United 1K member like me, you probably won't be very happy with the changes. I caught up with United Airlines and Star Alliance expert Matthew Clint of Live and Let's Fly to get his opinion on what we can expect to see with these changes. After that, Jen is back from Deals We Like to talk about some great money-saving offers to use on your next hotel stay. We wrap up this week with Scott Meyerowitz from the Associated Press. Scott is the host of AP's Get Out of Here podcast. If you're not listening, you should definitely hit the subscribe button on his podcast as well. We'll be talking about the transition from international travel as a couple to family travel with a toddler. And let me tell you, it's a big change. Don't forget to send us your questions about travel, miles, and points. We'd love to read them on the air and give you a bit of help with your travels. You can find us on social media. Search for the Miles to Go podcast on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. And you can always email us at miles2gopodcast@gmail.com, all spelled out. That's miles2gopodcast@gmail.com. Lastly, you can help us out by subscribing to the podcast wherever you're listening, such as Apple Podcasts or Google Podcasts. By subscribing, you'll get our episode for free as soon as it's available to download. We'd also love it if you'd leave us a rating and a comment. We read all of your comments, and by subscribing and rating the podcast, you're helping us reach more listeners, and we really appreciate that help. With all that housekeeping covered, let's get you to the show. The Miles to Go podcast is brought to you in part by No Jet Lag. Don't let jet lag get you down. Flight crews, sports teams, and business executives around the world sing the praises of No Jet Lag. No Jet Lag is the leader in jet lag management for the last 25 years. Don't let jet lag spoil your next trip. Visit nojetlag.com to get yours today. And welcome back to the Miles to Go podcast. We're going to talk a little bit about some United changes that popped up recently. And I wanted to bring on somebody who is definitely a tight follower of United. He's always on top of things that are happening in the world, United Airlines and Star Alliance. Matthew Clint pens the Live and Let's Fly blog, and he's also the director at the Award Booking Service Award Expert. He's a good friend and a fellow frequent United flyer. First time on the podcast. Matthew, thanks for coming on.
Hey, Ed, it's a pleasure to be on with you.
So just to frame up for folks the recent changes, and I won't go through all of them, admittedly. They're for those that want to read every detail of it, there were some changes to baggage allowances. But I think the points that I want to focus on today with Matthew, which he wrote about recently on his blog, are the increase in the preferred premier qualifying dollars required to earn United's top-tier 1K status, and also a change to discounted first-class fares and how those help folks earn elite status. Essentially, what United is saying is that instead of spending $12,000 a year to earn 1K status, you'll now need to spend $15,000, which is a pretty significant increase for the average business traveler, wouldn't you say, Matthew?
It would be, yes. I was just talking to one of my colleagues, and he said that's going to be the deal breaker, going back to American because of it.
And I do wonder, to have access to the data and be able to call through it, I do wonder how many current 1K members fall between $12,000 and $15,000, because you really do start to get up there where if somebody is flying 100,000 miles a year and they're doing it as sort of the domestic U.S. road warrior, $15,000 probably is much more of a stretch. If they're an international traveler and they're buying business class tickets, then $15,000 and $12,000 are probably negligible in terms of a difference. But I've got to imagine that this matters for the U.S. road warrior.
I would agree, right? And I mean, for the people who are spending tens of thousands of dollars, one, they have their own category, global services. And two, I mean, really, who is United trying to target? And it's the classic issue of just moving this optional revenue, right? These passengers at the margins who they can be loyal to anyone, right? And benefits like 1K status might move them to be loyal to United. It's always a cost-benefit analysis. I understand what United's doing, but I just wonder if pushing this up even further is just going to drive away those people who don't just fill up extra seats, but who really make the bottom line happen.
Yeah, I think that's the main point of emphasis when I look at this from a business standpoint, is that somebody who's spending, again, we'll use the 100,000 mile mark. You know, obviously folks will vary up from there, but if they're flying 100,000 miles and they're spending $12,000, they're currently a good customer for United. They're definitely well above average. You know, and I do wonder, is that customer more likely to be happy with dropping to platinum status, or do they take their $13,000 or $14,000 in business, and as you say with your colleague, decide to move everything over to American because there's an opportunity for them to be top tier with a different chain, with a different airline?
I think one thing American Airlines flyers perhaps don't realize about United is the way that your premier qualifying dollars are calculated. With American, if you're flying on partner tickets issued by partners like, say, Qatar Airways or British Airways, somehow American calculates a portion of that ticket price and applies it towards your yearly spend. And that's not the case on United. For example, last year, I flew over 100,000 miles on United, but I'm a platinum. I am not 1K because I didn't spend the full 12,000 on United ticket stock. I had paid premium tickets on Lufthansa last year, on Ethiopian Airlines. I think if you would have combined everything that I spent, I would have surpassed the 12 grand. But because United only counts tickets issued on 016 stock, I came up well short, and I'm only platinum despite the 100,000 miles. And that only gets worse now. And until United fixes that gap, and perhaps they have no intention of doing it, I think they're driving away potential loyalty, the potential good customers that you talked about.
Yeah, I don't want to sound defeatist. Given how long the problem, if you will, or feature or bug, if you will, of how they calculate those partner flights, I do wonder if they do intend to alter that, or if they do believe that the customer that they're most trying to covet and cater to with this move to 15,000 is the person that spends it on their ticket stock. And if you fly Lufthansa or TAP or one of the other Star Alliance carriers and you're buying a premium fare, they believe that that's not as valuable to them to include that and potentially fold you into the 1K bucket.
I guess I get that, like, say, with TAP or with Thai Airways or Singapore. But, I mean, what about Air Canada, Lufthansa? They're transatlantic joint venture partners. Or with ANA, for example, going to Japan. Why not count those? That doesn't make sense to me.
I do think you're absolutely right. I do think there is a class of have and have nots when you come to alliance partners. And I do think JV partners make more sense because, as I understand it, they're splitting the revenue on those JVs. And so they're agnostic to whether I book ANA to Tokyo or book United to Tokyo. They should get the same revenue split based on the available seat miles they fly to that destination.
Precisely correct. Yeah.
So from that standpoint, I see the change, and I understand their desire to attract more revenue. I do wonder though, because the value equation here isn't significant for the consumer, in that now that the airlines have gotten better at calculating the right break point for that discounted first class fare, I don't actually see more first class seats becoming available with this change. They're a publicly held company. They're generating return for shareholder, and they say that this by thinning the herd, if you will, this will allow them to deliver more benefits to 1K members. But do you really think that that will free up more seats for the road warrior going from Chicago to Dallas?
No, not at all. And that gets to the second change: the way United's aggressively pricing P fares. Right, people are just buying it. And upgrades, my upgrade rate as a platinum is not great, and 1Ks are still clearing from time to time, but it's not like it's a sure thing, right? Upgrades you just cannot rely on anymore.
No, I flew Orlando last week, and I cleared one flight on a Tuesday midday, and I missed the upgrade on the return on the way back, you know, on a very random middle-of-the-week sort of flight. So I think, and that says a 1K, I don't think I see a big change there. And you noted the other change, which I do think is significant, in that they're reducing the amount of premier qualifying dollars that an elite member will earn on the discounted first class bucket, the P class fares, which are, as you say, fairly common for elite travelers like you and I to buy.
Right. I mean, it's not that they're cheaper than coach fares, but sometimes the difference is just marginal and it just makes sense to buy, especially on longer flights.
Yeah, I would agree. I've seen them as low as under $100 one way for longer flights. And a typical route for me is a Washington Dulles to Denver. And I do see that route for $80 to $150 one way as an upgrade at times. You know, what do you think the logic is there in reducing the amount of PQMs on P fares? Do you think they're trying to drive those folks to buy up to the higher buckets? Or do you just think that that they believe that they can shave at the margins and it won't affect them from a profitability standpoint?
I think the latter is true. I mean, sure, they'd love us to buy Z fares or D fares or C fares, but, you know, if P fares are available, people are still going to buy them. And, you know, it may cause people to fly a little bit more if they have to, if they're close. But, you know, I just think United, it's not that they totally disregard their domestic premium product, right? But it's like, it's just, you're not as valuable anymore, right? When we're paying, you know, I paid something like $550 for a Seattle Newark nonstop flight in P class with a lie flat bed, and you know, you can say yes, that was still $550 added to United's revenue, but you know, United perhaps looks and says, well, you know, these P fares aren't really all that valuable to us. We're throwing you a bone. We're saving you the sweat of having to upgrade. But we're not going to reward you handsomely for it. Forget the 200%.
Yeah, I see that. And I do wonder because, you know, when you think about the in the overall scheme of things, what it could mean, the gap that I see between the P-class fares and any of the other domestic first-class fares is significant enough that I can't imagine anybody who's got a, you know, a run-of-the-mill corporate travel policy could justify that sort of an upgrade. So I do think it is directly affected that road warrior. I know just from a travel preference standpoint, while I have flexibility in what I spend, I see what they charge for those higher buckets, and it's just not worth it given the product. You know, you mentioned a lie flat seat from Seattle to Newark, and you know, they still exist in the domestic system, but in very rare instances, in my opinion.
Yes. And Scott Kirby's talked about hopefully expanding it, rolling it out more as more aircraft deliveries arrive, but we have yet to see that.
Right. They haven't done a ton of the upgrade process for the first class cabin. The new first class product that they've been rolling out has been moving along, begrudgingly slow. I see it from time to time, but not on an expansive number of routes. And ultimately, when you talk about the expansion of lie-flat seats, I do believe that they've gotten good enough at twisting the dials in revenue management that if they do roll out more lie-flats, I do think we'll see an appropriately priced premium for those seats. But I don't think it means more upgrades. I think they'll look to maximize that cabin just like American did with its three-cabin transcontinental A321T fleet.
Correct. Yeah.
So lastly, the other change that that impacts 1Ks here is for the folks that are those true road warriors or long haul travelers at intervals above 100,000 miles now, they swap to regional premier upgrades, which were a generally usable, say, inside the U.S. or U.S. to Canada, if you will. And then instead of getting two regional premier upgrades, they moved to one global premier upgrade. And I'm curious what your opinion is on that change, both for the 1K member in general and how it will affect you personally.
I love regional premier upgrades because I'm traveling back and forth between New York and L.A. often. And those are just wonderful for United's premium service transcontinental flights. Those flights are not eligible for complimentary premier upgrades. And if you want to use miles, it's 20,000 miles plus a copay of $250, I believe. And so that makes those regional premier upgrades highly valuable. And I also have a very good clearance rate as well. Now, I tend to be a little more flexible in how I can travel. And, you know, I'll take the flights that look like they're going to clear or that already have the confirmable R space to clear. But thus, from my point of view, it's like, you know, it's taking away one upgrade, right? And you're only going to get one instead of two. I think the problem with Global Premier upgrades remains that you're playing this lottery every time you go. It's so rare to be able to confirm the space in advance. And if you cannot confirm it in advance, you have to buy up to a W fare, a mid-tier economy class fare, and hope for the best, right? And you may end up spending several hundred dollars more, $500-$600 more on some routes, just to have the shot at an upgrade. And if your upgrade doesn't clear, you don't get any refund back. And so I view global premier upgrades as less valuable than regional premier upgrades.
I would tend to agree with you. I noted when I posted about this over the weekend that I think I used exactly the same term you used, the upgrade lottery, because it's sincerely the way I feel about global premier upgrades. They, you know, they're nice when they work out, but what I've found is that very infrequently now can I find what I would call preferable routes on United Metal, where the buy up premium from a lower discounted economy class fare to a whiskey class fare is less than a few hundred dollars. So, as you say, I'm spending $300 or $400 per ticket, and so if I'm say taking my family overseas, I could in theory be spending well over $1,000 for the hope that an upgrade will clear. And if it doesn't, the only thing I get back is my global premier upgrade. I don't get that cash back, and I certainly don't get enough extra value for it, although I guess that's one way to earn your $15,000, a very painful way to get to $15,000. So I tend to end up using my global premier upgrades for routes that are less valuable. I'll sometimes use them on domestic flights because it'll get to the end of the year and I just haven't found the opportunity where the spread between a discounted economy fare and a whiskey class fare was low enough for me to want to play the lottery.
That's right. And I think United could make a huge gesture to their 1Ks if they would just do away with this fare class requirement. I don't know what kind of calculations go into keeping this rule alive, but I mean, let's note that both Delta and American do not have a minimum fare class requirement for their equivalent global premier upgrades.
Right. And when you look at the comparative analysis of American and Delta, American, to my knowledge, has never had that on their equivalent product, their system-wide upgrades. I was an EXP for an executive platinum member for American for a decade, and I don't believe there was a fare class requirement before that. And Delta did have this requirement at one point where they did have a fare restriction on them, and then they removed it. Considering that United also controls the capacity in those upgrade buckets, it would seem reasonable to say, look, if you don't want to give up if New York to London is a juicy route, you don't want an elite 1K member to have that upgrade to business class for free, then don't make the inventory available, but don't penalize them with the chance that they might clear.
I 100% agree.
So I guess in summary, my personal feeling is it feels like United, put a little bit of a thumb on the scale here, not terribly painful, but that there wasn't a whole lot of give back to their top customers. What's your takeaway from the changes?
Yeah, I mean, I wish they would have thrown us something in return, right? They talked about a new boarding, and 1Ks get to pre-board now, but, you know, what I've witnessed in the 2 weeks since this has been rolled out is a mess. and perhaps it needs more time just to iron out the kinks, but I don't think the new boarding is actually an improvement, at least not now. I mean, and they announced some baggage changes as well, but those didn't affect 1K travelers, so what I'd like to see from United is just some carrot, right, along with this new stick, and I don't see it now, and so I think it's a net negative. Now, I know many of my readers say, no, I mean, this is great. I will use the extra global premiere upgrade, and this is a good thing. So this is just my opinion and your opinion, but I'm not happy about the change.
Yeah, I agree. I'm not happy about it either. And I hope that folks that are listening will drop either Matthew or I a note. You can hit us at Twitter, at Pizza in Motion. Matthew, what's your Twitter handle?
Mine's at Live and Let's Fly.
So tweet at us or shoot us an email. I'm curious how many folks fall into this spread area of $12,000 to $15,000 if you are a 1K member, or if you exceed 15K and this is just a non-issue for you. I really do wonder what percentage of 1Ks that this affects. I don't think that the moral of the story here is that folks will end up getting more upgrades. I think it's something that we'll forget about after a bit, and 15,000 will be the new 12,000, and that's certainly unfortunate for a bunch of folks who, you know, who value the benefits that are left from 1K, like the free award changes. I don't know what's next in United's optimization strategy, but I'm certainly not eager to find out about it.
Nor am I. And now we'll see if American and Delta follow, right?
Yes, we will. All right, Matthew, thanks again for jumping on the podcast with me for the first time. I certainly hope it won't be the last. We'll be right back on the Miles to Go podcast. Hey, while we're taking a quick break, I wanted to share with you another of my favorite travel podcasts. Back in episode 24, we did a deep dive into the awesome new Norwegian Bliss cruise ship. I mean, go-kart track on the rooftop deck of a cruise ship? Awesome. Kimberly from the Stuffed Suitcase was our guest that day. She's also the co-host of the Vacation Mavens podcast. Kimberly and her co-host Tamara discuss tons of awesome destinations for family travel. They're just getting back from their summer travel hiatus, so now's a great time to start listening. You can find them at vacationmavens.com or on Apple Podcasts or wherever good podcasts are found. Let's get you back to Miles to Go. Welcome back, and it's time for another It's a Big Deal segment. We've got Jen back with us from Deals We Like. Hey, Jen, how are you today?
I'm doing well, thanks, Ed. How are you?
I'm doing great. And just when we thought that Amex Offers was going to die a quiet death, it looks like you've got a huge list of Amex offers that are valuable for folks looking to stay both in the U.S. and around the world, given you probably can't get them 10 times each, but they seem like some pretty good offers.
Right. So with the recent changes that took place back in August, you can no longer take advantage of these American Express offers on every single card you have. But nonetheless, you can still take advantage of them once or twice. And I can explain about that in a few minutes. And you can still save a ton of money on hotel stays and, airfare that you were going to make anyways. And even if you're using points, there's still great ways to maximize your statement credits as well. So this is still, they're not dead. They're still definitely alive. They're just not rolling in the big dough.
Yeah, I mean, you're right, not big dough. But I mean, some of these, as I was flipping through the list, $50 off of an Embassy Suite stay of $250 or more. I mean, I think you probably would agree with me. $50 is, that's a family dinner for me.
Absolutely. I mean, $50 is $50. And some of them are even more. Like if you're going to stay at a Hilton property in the UK, you can get $100 statement credit. So there's still some great offers. I mean, if you're staying at many various Hilton brands, hotels within their chain, there's an offer for you out there. So definitely, register and make sure to use the correct card because you can get a statement credit at Hampton Inns, Garden Inns, Homewood Suites, Embassy Suites, Home2 Suites, and all the Hilton properties in the UK. Of course, look at the terms because some of them are specific for, just US and US territories, and they don't include all countries, but it's still a good way to save money. And those are some of my favorite ones right now for the hotel area. There's also a great Marriott one.
Yeah, I thought it was interesting because Amex really, really do their homework here because they've got, as you said, multiple Hilton offers. They've got the Marriott offer. They've got a specific Crowne Plaza offer. They've got a Kimpton offer. And then for folks that are looking to spend
Buku Bucks. They've got a Four Seasons offer. So there's really a wide variety of hotel chains here. And I think the smallest one is that $50 credit that we talked about. Oh, no, the Hampton was a $30 credit. But, I mean, these are all 30, 50, 60, 100, 200, or $150. I mean, these are all really good savings deals.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, they really cater towards the low-level hotels and the high-end hotels and everything in between. So there's really something out there for everyone. So I definitely suggest taking a look at your specific American Express account, seeing what you're eligible for, because some of these offers are targeted. Most of them are not. Most of them are available to, you know, everyone, but definitely take a look and make sure to register. Now, if you are staying on a hotel stay that is including points, so you're really not paying them, anything that is charged to your bill, so any incidentals, dinners, let's say you have some activity that you can charge to the resort, anything else that's on your hotel bill, you can also use towards that minimum spend to get the statement credit. So even if you're staying on a free night stay and you have racked up some other expenses, you can still take advantage.
Yeah, and not that the hotel stays, hotel deals aren't great, but you also noted a couple of flight deals, and I specifically caught, what caught my eye was the $40 off of a $200 or greater JetBlue purchase.
Yeah, and there's some great things with that. So that one specifically, you can find on both your American Express membership reward earning cards and your co-branded cards. And you, if you have one membership reward earning card, it will actually earn you 4,000 membership reward points. And if you have a co-branded card, it will earn you a $40 statement credit. And since they're actually different offers slightly, because once you're earning statement credits, the other is you're earning membership rewards, you can take advantage of that one twice per account. So even though they've limited it to once per account, when it's slightly different variations, you can take advantage of that one two times, which is great.
Yeah, that's great. I mean, you know, if there's definitely a bunch of money here for the individual business traveler to save multiple times. But even if you got a family vacation coming up, if you could stack that JetBlue discount or both JetBlue discounts and then hit one of these hotel discounts, you've got yourself a nice little savings. There's also an Amex travel general discount on prepaid hotel reservations of $600 or more. So a nice variety here for folks to consider with a variety of expiration dates through the fall. Definitely take a look at Jen's post. We'll have a link to that in the show notes. Jen, thanks a bunch for being on again.
You're welcome. Thanks, Ed.
All right, thanks. We'll be right back on the Miles to Go podcast. Hello, and welcome back to another Miles to Go segment. As you can imagine with a travel podcast, we are on the road today. I am at the global headquarters for the Associated Press, sitting with a friend and fellow ex-airline reporter, Scott Meyerowitz. Scott, how are you?
Good, Ed. How are you?
Good. So Scott's role now is he's the deputy global business editor for the AP, but he also recently took over the reins at their official travel podcast, Get Out of Here, which you should definitely tune into and listen to. He just had one of the great voices in travel on, Wendy Perrin, for a segment. And, you know, you've joined the ranks a bit later than some of us, but you are now, you've transitioned from traveling with your wife to traveling with an infant to now traveling with a toddler.
Yeah, it's a big transition and has completely changed the way I think about vacations, from the planning to just being out there. And I like to say it's not necessarily a vacation anymore, but it's a trip.
I can remember the first family trip we took and how much stuff my wife packed and how mad I was and having to figure out how you break all of these pieces down that never existed before.
I used to do ski vacations if I wasn't bringing my skis, carry-on only.
Yep.
And the only time I would check luggage was with my skis. Now I feel like I'm constantly checking. We're still down to just one suitcase for the three of us.
Sure.
But we're checking luggage, and that's just been a complete game changer, and my mindset about how much time I need when we get off an airplane has changed.
Yeah, no, I mean, everything moves a bit slower. There's obviously time you have to budget in there to make sure things work. But it's interesting how you go through these life cycles as a parent. And my kids are 8 and 12, and so at this point, I would say we're probably 80% of the time not checking a bag. But it took us, you know, a solid, you know, 7-8 years to get there.
Yeah, my daughter's 3.5, and she loves pulling the suitcase through the airport. But we're not quite at the point where we want to just have her own bag and be responsible for it. We still do like to take the stroller on trips. Yeah. And at that point, we're gate checking. We're carrying too much stuff anyway. And it really does change the way we think about everything from road trips to hotels to flying.
Yeah, we, you know, our checked bag situations now are much more strategic. And it's, all right, well, you know, like let's say Michelle, my wife, is traveling on her own. Well, much more likely to check bags if I'm meeting them on the other end, because then all she really has to worry about is the kids. She doesn't have to think about the, you know, the Game of Thrones battle for overhead bin space or, you know, or things of that nature.
Yeah, I mean, we are last to board a plane now.
Sure.
Daughter's 3.5, as I said, and she likes to run around still. And she's very good on planes. She's used to it. She likes her window seat. She likes to look out. We do take the Kindle along, and there's plenty of screen time. But one of the things that we just find, it's so much easier when you're not worrying about overhead bin space to be the last people on that plane.
No, I agree. And you talk about being last in the plane, and I think about routes that, you know, before were common routes for me. You know, if I was going to go to, say, Southern California, I would take the Dulles Los Angeles nonstop. And, you know, at about the time that my youngest was your youngest age, you know, and sort of transitioning up until both of our kids were, you know, say 7, you know, we chose the shorter connecting routes. And, you know, it adds a little bit of complexity, but trying to keep a child occupied on a plane for 5 or 6 hours is hard if it's not a flight that they're going to sleep on. And so connecting in Dallas or Chicago all of a sudden became appealing because you could let them off the plane, they could run some steam off, and then you could pack them back on the plane.
We're still in the sort of nonstop mindset, and maybe that was a mistake, but we found that our daughter can really stay focused for a long time if there is something that she needs, and she actually loves the fact that airplanes have their own TVs. It's like novel for her. I guess she hasn't flown American Airlines recently.
Ouch.
But sorry, that's a bad.
We saw
that's
that coming.
A bad. Yeah. But you know, we're a Delta family mostly, and now I find the logistics are more like my wife yells at me when I say to the flight attendant, thank you for the wings, but she's got enough of them. And it's like, oh, is this your first flight? And I'm like, no, we're pros at this. And my wife's like, just say thank you and get a, you know, don't be mean to the flight attendants.
You can't – can you really have too many of those little wings? I love those things.
We live in a Manhattan apartment. There's, you know, yeah, every square
space
inch.
Space premium, yeah, yeah. Yeah, no, I definitely agree with that. You know, it's funny because when you talk about, you know, like just using checked bags and carry-on bags as an example, you know, you take, you know, our friend Summer, Mommy Points. You know, she, her philosophy early on was, you know, if the kids could, you know, the kids could walk, then their hand could grab onto a suitcase and pull it to the airport. So she was a big advocate of it early on, whereas our kids just really never had that desire. And, you know, there were so many other things going on that we just didn't want to force that issue with them.
Yeah, and for us, we're often checking a car seat.
Right.
My daughter Leah, she's now big enough where she's not sitting in a car seat on the flight. So, but we're often traveling a place where, you know, we live in New York. We don't own a car.
Right.
So we need a car seat that's easy to click in and out of cabs. So we might as well bring it along for the rental car instead of renting one from Hertz, Avis, National, or those guys.
Yeah, and you know, you and I were talking before we hopped on to record, and you mentioned, you know, what's another you know, well-known phenomenon for families, you know, is that that pivot from aspirational luxury properties to, you know, wow, I need extra space when I travel in my hotel.
Yeah, I mean, it's been a complete shift in the mindset. We have always been fans of luckily being able to afford nice hotels and staying at those luxury places, whether on points or cash. But, you know, Embassy Suites is now on my list again. And there was a long time where I was avoiding them. Or Residence Inns, where you actually have at least a divider between you and your kid. We just stayed in Charleston at the Hyatt Place, Hyatt House combo.
Yep.
And it was a great option for several reasons, one of which was early in the morning before anyone really wanted breakfast, and if our daughter was up, I could take her downstairs. There was a place to run around, and she could eat a little bit of cereal or eggs. She could have her first of three breakfasts, and it didn't cost me a thing. And a little wasteful if she didn't finish her plate, I didn't feel as guilty about it. And then we could go out as a family for a good breakfast.
Yeah, no, I agree. And you know, it's having that flexibility not only to have, say, a refrigerator in your room, but have, you know, some easy food that you can have kids graze on at any time of day is a big plus when traveling. And it's why, at least specifically in the U.S., our family does tend to lean towards those extended stay or limited service brands. And, you know, for those of you that are tuning in and may not have heard Scott talk before, you know, a little pro tip. He is one of us. He's a bit of a points and miles geek. So he knows his chops. And so I'm sure he's analyzing on his vacations on how to use points to get, say, a slightly bigger room and, you know, at places that aren't limited service or extended stay properties. Do you find that, I mean, I know for a while you were a Hyatt guy, and I think you were an SPG guy for a while too. As you're transitioning into family travel, which chains are you most patronizing, and are you able to find ways to get those bigger rooms with points?
Well, yes, I am complete geek at all this stuff, and thank you for all the tips over the years. You know, it does shift based on my needs. I'll give you a good example. Philadelphia, there's a Curio Collection hotel.
Yeah.
And the, I believe it's called the Logan, and the difference in price, just paying cash, between a normal room and one that has French doors separating a suite is often only like $30 a night. Mm. So that's been one on my list. Hyatt, I remain loyal to because they make it so easy to do an upsell to a suite on points.
They do. They
or,
really do.
Or the club level. And that is a game changer when staying somewhere. We've done that in Atlanta. We've done it in Toronto, where we've decided to go forward and get a suite because it's that much extra space.
Yeah.
The big problem is I go to a lot of random places with my family on road trips where there's no option but limited service. And in the, many of those places, they're just there's not a real wall. I can remember my first time at a Summerhill Suites.
Yeah.
Or was it Springfield Suites?
Well, you got Summerfield Suites and Spring Hill Suites.
I can't remember which one it was, actually.
They all kind of blend together.
They do.
The bed sheets are different, but that's about it.
And they had a privacy wall, and we paid extra for a suite.
Right.
And I show up, and that was my first experience with the privacy wall, which there's nothing private about it.
Yeah. No, and it's funny because I was in the hotel industry for quite some time, and so I sort of nerd out on the business side of the industry as well. And it surprises me that you commented on Hyatt being good at helping with paid upgrades on award bookings, and I think they do a better job of that than any other chains. What I'm surprised that none of the chains have done yet is find a way to monetize connecting rooms. Because as a family goes, it's the single biggest request I have. It's why I strive to make sure I have top-tier elite status on at least one hotel chain so I can make that ask. And even as a top-tier elite who spends quite a bit of money on business travel, frequently I get the, you know, we have your request, we'll let you know when you check in. And it's like, look, if you're going to give me two rooms on different floors as a family, that's literally no good to me. So if you could just tell me now you're not going to give me a connecting room, great. Like, at least let me know that now. But I just feel like there's an opportunity for hotels to say, that's great. We can guarantee you connecting rooms ahead of time. I understand not all the inventory, but let's say let's take 20% of our inventory. We're going to turn those into connecting rooms, and we're going to charge people an extra $50 a night.
I mean, the big issue with this, I think, is that the hotel industry is really set up for business travelers. Families are an afterthought, unfortunately. And we had this for the first time. I'm going to go back to Philadelphia, the Sheraton Philadelphia. It's a big hotel that's showing its age,
yep.
But they had connecting rooms. And we purposely chose to stay there because they had a larger percentage of connecting rooms. Put the request in. 24 hours in advance when they start assigning rooms, I had to call up and beg and plead and make sure that they assigned us two rooms together. And they did, but like I shouldn't have had to go through that headache. More recently, we went for my mom's 70th birthday to the Fairmont Southampton in Bermuda.
Hmm.
Great property, so kid-friendly. It's the type of place where you get to a beach and they give you a bucket and some shovels when you get your towels.
Oh, wonderful.
They have a toddler playroom next to their kids' club that everyone got to run around in after breakfast. It was great for that. They charged us $25 per night to guarantee connecting rooms.
Oh,
vans.
Sold.
So I'm torn on this. I was very thankful that they did this. This was great. But I also felt kind of ripped off by it. So I don't know. You're okay with that?
I'm okay with it on both sides because the hotel makes a little bit more money. And on the flip side, go back to what you just mentioned on the Sheraton Philadelphia, where up until the time you checked in, you were sweating whether you were going to have the right room arrangements. And for us, it's, you know, we may be redeeming double the amount of points to have more comfort at a property. And I'm okay with that equation. I don't love it, but I'm okay with the equation. It's the potential of I'm going to redeem double the amount of points or pay for two rooms, and then I'm going to show up and you're going to tell me they're not connecting. It's just a huge, you know, it's a huge down for me, and I would rather pay insurance, $25 a night. That's just the way I look at it. Like, this is travel insurance for families. this is just a tax, and I'm okay with it if you're guaranteeing it.
Yeah, I think I would have been okay with a $25 flat fee. It was the per night. You know, once you've assigned me to a room, you've assigned me to a room.
Yeah.
Now you're just kind of pulling some more money from me. But I was thankful for it and made a much better vacation. And I will say, because of that family-friendly approach, I'll be back at that hotel again.
Yeah, and you're right. There's probably a better way they could have positioned it. For example, you know, they could have charged you the same thing, I think, from a business standpoint, same total dollars, and said, you know, your room rate is, you know, $220 instead of $200, and there's a $25 fee. Like, there's a way to manage that, and they could do it with revenue management internally. I'm just glad to see hotels that are making that effort.
Yeah. And I will say, you know, having kids free eat for free, that's a great little benefit.
Yeah.
And I see it with resorts. I think someone should come up with an urban hotel that fits that, or maybe we're in the minority and it just doesn't matter.
Yeah, no, I think it's coming, but it's coming slowly because, as you say, a lot of the stuff is catering towards business travelers. And then also every hotel chain believes that millennials are the answer.
Oh,
and so it's like, you know, every meeting, every boardroom is, how do we cater to millennials? And it's like, well, look, I mean, I get it. They're a big demographic, but I hate to break the news to you, but families are a large demographic as well, and a lot of them don't travel because of the roadblocks. And it's like, if you can remove some of the roadblocks, you can attract more family travelers.
I know a lot of families who just go the Airbnb route because
they've
got the kitchen, mm-hmm. they've got the guaranteed space, and they go that way. It's not right for my family, but you know, when we go some places, we rent a house.
Yeah.
And we've gone that approach because we think it works better.
Yeah, no, it's lowering the friction. Well, Scott, thanks a ton for being on the podcast with us. You know, when you're not on with me and you're not giving me a tour around the AP offices, which is my first time here, and it was just a ton of fun to walk past all the Pulitzers, so I appreciate that. Tell folks where they can find you.
Well, I can be found on Twitter at GlobetrotScott. You can also listen to our weekly podcast, Get Out of Here, available iTunes, Stitcher, wherever you get your podcasts. Instagram's also another place to find me, also GlobetrotScott. It's a brand name that one of my coworkers actually came up with back when I used to work for ABC News and was like, you know, I shouldn't be, you know, Scott ABC News anymore. Anybody have thoughts? And he came up with it, and I appreciate it.
I've known you as Globetrot Scott since the first day I met you, and I could definitely vouch for following Get Out of Here. On top of the Wendy Perrin segment, he had a segment, gosh, it's probably 3 or 4 segments ago, where he had an interview with a influential GM of a very aspirational property on the best tips on how to earn yourself a suite upgrade. So great stuff on Get Out of Here. You know, take a moment and add it to your podcast list. Until next time, thanks again for being on the podcast with us, Scott. We'll definitely have you back on again.
All right. Thanks for having me. A lot of fun.
All right. We'll be right back on the Miles to Go podcast. And we're back to wrap up this week's show with the final two pennies. In case you missed it, my friend Summer and I attempted the insane Disney World challenge to ride every ride in one day. It wasn't pretty at times, but it sure was fun, at least for a couple of Disney nerds. 48 rides was our goal. We came up a bit short at 41, but I'm so proud of Summer, and I'm so proud of all the people that have donated to our designated charity, Give Kids the World. We're closing in on $12,000 in donations. How awesome is that? There's still time to donate. You can visit my website and search for Disney if you want to find out more. I love raising money for charities and doing crazy things to help get people involved. If you've got a crazy challenge in mind, make sure you drop me a line. Meanwhile, back in the world of miles and points, if you're still experiencing problems with your Marriott or SPG account, you're certainly not alone. I have a big chunk of points from stays that I had to cancel, award stays, that haven't been redeposited. This is a known glitch. It may be a few weeks before I see the points, according to Marriott and SPG officials. SPG agents are also having trouble making certain types of changes to Marriott reservations. I've heard from a bunch of folks who are still having lots of problems with their account as well. Doesn't seem like we're out of the woods here, and yet Arne Sorensen, Marriott's CEO, says that things will get better soon and that the platform is now stabilized. He says we're going to love the new program and all of the earning opportunities. Color Me is still skeptical. That's a full wrap on this week's episode. If you have questions I can help answer, send them in so we can answer them in a future episode. You can email us at miles2gopodcast@gmail.com, or you can hit us up on Twitter at miles2gopodcast. Again, that email is miles2gopodcast@gmail.com. If you're enjoying the show, there are two things that you can do quickly to help us out. First, hit that subscribe button wherever you're listening, whether that's on Apple Podcasts or Google Podcasts, and leave us a comment and a rating. We read all those comments. They help us make the show better. And by subscribing and rating the podcast, you're helping us grow the audience. Thanks again for listening this week, and a big thanks to Matthew, Jen, and Scott for helping me put together a great show. We're already putting together a great episode for next week. But until then, we've got miles to go.